This is an encore edition of The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. Julie returns next week for another edition of The Dog Show. Be sure to tune in Wednesdays at 2.
Welcome to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Well, it's all
welcome to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. You're listening to Alternative Talk AM 1150. A beautiful day to take your dog for a walk today. Wouldn't you say so, Eric?
Good point. Absolutely. In fact, it was kind of cloudy and, cool. And then you walked into the studio and the sun came out and I said, this is fantastic because now we can say our signature catchphrase.
That's right.
It's a beautiful day to take your dog for a walk with no trace of irony whatsoever.
That's right.
It's absolutely perfect out there now.
It is. Please do take your dog for a walk and even go somewhere new. Give him some new scents.
Oh, it's more fun for you and for the dog.
No. Well, have a great show today. The Sparks Conference is coming around again. Second annual Sparks International Conference. If you are new to the show since last summer, SPARCS is the acronym for the Society for the Promotion of Applied Research in Canine Science, which means it's a gathering of world-renowned scientists in the field of, I guess sort of simply put, how dogs think, cognition, how dogs and wolves differ from each other, how they differ in their interactions with people. How do dogs problem solve, learn, all sorts of different topics. It was so the first Sparks conference last year actually happened in Redmond. So I was like super, super excited that it was right in our neighborhood.
And, right in our backyard.
Yeah. So I got to attend and it was awesome and it was just really well done. And so leading up to the conference last year, I interviewed several of the scientists who were presenting that year, and mm-hmm. I'm doing a bit of that again this year. And so today we'll be talking with Dr. Monique Udell, who's with Oregon State University, and she's got a lot of great work that she's doing out of there. And so we're going to get into her work. Before we do, though...
By the way, go fighting beavers.
Now, do you have an OSU connection, Eric?
I had a friend that went to OSU,
okay.
So
I know.
It's the Beavers.
Now, if you want to learn more about Sparks, the website is caninescience.info. This year's conference is June 20th through the 22nd, and it's in Newport, Rhode Island. Beautiful place to go visit if you want to go and attend in person. And if you can't go and attend in person, you can watch it streaming live. There's lots of other ways to access the conference. And you can, get a membership through Sparks, and they have different levels of membership and stuff. So all that information is on caninescience.info. So before we get started talking about Dr. Monique Udell's work, I just want to announce AHELP Project, Animal Hospice, End of Life, and Palliative Care. Organization that I'm on the board for. We support pets and their people through and after the pet's end-of-life process. We're having a fundraiser Saturday, June 28th in Seattle from 2 to 5 p.m. at Norm's Eatery and Ale House in Fremont. Norm's is one of the sort of landmark dog-friendly pubs in the city. It's in Fremont. It's June 28th from 2 to 5 p.m., it's going to be a blast. It's going to be, I think there's a certain Guinness beer will, the pints of Guinness that are sold, I think will portion of that will get donated to AHELP. It's a fundraiser. So definitely check that out. I'll be talking more about that as we approach it, but just a heads up, mark your calendar, Saturday, June 28th, Norm's Eatery in Ale House in Fremont from 2 to 5 p.m. AHELP. Fundraiser, Heads and Tails Fundraiser, it's called. So be sure to check that out. All right. So we have on our line from Oregon State University, Dr. Monique Udell. Welcome to The Dog Show.
Hi, Julie. Thank you for having me.
Yes, my pleasure. Thanks for your time. And so lots to talk about. First of all, tell us about, you know, the work that you do and your kind of focus in your field of work and what you study.
So I study a range of animal behavior, animal cognition, and human-animal interaction topics. Most of my work right now that involves dogs is looking at things like what kind of attachments do dogs form to their owners, or if they're in a working relationship or if they're in a shelter, what kind of attachments do they form to the people around them, or do they form attachments to the people around them, and how long does that take? I've also been doing some work with animal-assisted therapy and looking at not only how the animal influences the human's well-being and performance, but also how the animal's participation in therapy influences their own behavior, how well, how it may benefit or put additional stressors on their social behavior or their life. So those are some of the things I study, and then probably from our discussions, the other types of things that I've studied in the past that I have continued on is looking at things like canine problem solving and how responsive animals, especially canines, are to human gestures, body language, and other forms of communication.
Mm. So interesting. I think we could be here.
Thank you.
We could be here for like 4 or 5 hours, I think, just talking.
I am available.
Yeah. So anyway, what's of particular interest to me, and I attended Sparks last summer, and it was just awesome. It was so great to, you know, hear the talks and get to meet a lot of the people that I talked with on the show and all that stuff. And it's a really interesting sort of glimpse for me also into the culture of scientists and the language and all that kind of stuff too. And, what is particularly interesting to me is that you're really relationship focused. Like you're talking about what kinds of attachment do dogs form with their owner or with the people around them, if it's a working partnership or whatever. And so are you, when you say what do you mean by attachment? Do you mean emotional, or what does that mean to you?
So there are so many factors to attachment. What I'm specifically interested in at present is sort of how the animal uses their owner or the person in their environment as sort of a beacon in their environment to allow them to sort of reach out and explore. So can they use their owner as a secure base? So there's a level of trust there that allows the dog to exhibit maybe more confidence in certain situations that it wouldn't have if it had that social figure present. Or in other cases, maybe that relationship they have with the other individual inhibits behaviors that would be present. And so I'm looking at that in the context of problem solving. So I'm finding oftentimes that dogs are more hesitant to problem solve, engage in independent problem solving in the presence of their human than they would be in other contexts, unless they're encouraged or something like that. Mm. However, they might be more inclined to feel comfortable in a novel situation. And so this sort of goes back to the older definitions of attachment relationship back when it was first studied with people, before a lot of the, you know, emotional considerations were even brought into it back then, and between the relationship with young and their parents in a wide range of species. And so really when I'm looking at attachment currently, I'm interested in that initial bond that forms between two species and then how it influences their behavior in the environment, either with respect to that person or their ability to engage in other behaviors that might be important to their lifestyle.
Yeah. And I know from what I see working with dogs with behavior challenges is that it so depends on the quality of the relationship, because one relationship might lead an individual to feel more confident and one might have the opposite effect. And, you know, humans for sure are quite complex creatures. So we definitely, the stuff that we sort of put on our dogs unconsciously oftentimes too and how that impacts their behavior and their experience of the world and all that stuff is, I mean, there's just a lot to it. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's true. And one of the other things with attachment is that there's whether or not an animal is attached, so do they have a bond? But then there are also, like you're saying, these different styles of owners. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we see different attachment styles in the dog. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily that, you know, one owner is engaging in behaviors necessarily that are better or worse. Mm-hmm. But they definitely do have different influences on the dog's reciprocal behavior. And so in some cases, an owner that loves their dog just as much as the next person may behave in slightly different ways that change, you know, the outcome for their dogs. And so I'm looking at things like the relationship of those different relationships that humans and dogs have on the likelihood of separation anxiety or the likelihood of that dog being successful in other environments if it needs to be rehomed. So you can use those prior experiences that are just inherently so different and ask what kind of effect is this having on not only the social behavior of the dog, but also the individual behavior, and how does that impact their success in different environments?
Mm. And how, like, I know a little bit about attachment in people, like, you know, human to human, mm-hmm. and that in just that I know that there's sort of been defined some different sort of categories, but like, this type of attachment versus this type of attachment versus this type. And it depends. It's
sure.
based off of the person's experience with their own parents. And I wonder mm-hmm. if you had all of the information about the humans whose dogs you were studying. And I wonder if there would be any sort of correlation between the human's attachment style and how that translates, you know, I just came to me like if there was any correlation between those two also, like if you.
That's an interesting question. I've had people ask me before about children in the home and the dogs in the home, whether their attachment style towards the owner was the same. I've never had anyone ask me about the owner's attachment style to their parents. That'd be fascinating. But yeah, we're looking at exactly the same types of attachment styles. We've developed a slightly modified procedure than even some of the ones that have been used in the past with dogs, so we could categorize it more like the way that you see in the human literature. Mm-hmm. And we're finding that we can categorize dogs into pretty much the same exact attachment categories, as you said, as you can categorize humans into. Obviously, some of the fine-tuned behaviors, you know, are represented a little bit differently mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, dogs may lick, children probably, hopefully would not. Mm-hmm. But you can get these contact proximity-seeking behaviors. You can get exploratory behaviors. You can get play behaviors. And we're seeing dogs divide up into these groups pretty nicely.
Hmm. Interesting.
In different categories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk because your work is so social, you know, dogs and people and the how they interact together. And it just brings up so much to talk about. And I wanted to ask you some questions specifically about the study that you did several years back about with the pointing, because that was something that was talked about a bit last year at Sparks and kind of brings up some questions for me. And it also brings up really a larger conversation about sort of the language of dogs versus the language of people and where those overlap and where they don't. So we're going to be back in just a few minutes. We're talking with Dr. Monique Udell, who works out of Oregon State University and is the director of, Monique, what is the name of your human-animal interactions applied animal behavior? No, that's not it. What is the name? Yeah. You have a name of your program.
The Human-Animal Interaction Lab is my group, and I'm housed within the Department of Animal and Rangeland Sciences.
Okay, so that Human-Animal Interaction Lab?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, great. And I've posted links to Dr. Udell's sites and work and to Sparks also. So if you're just tuning in, this is the start of a few interviews that I'll be doing leading up to the Sparks conference that's coming up June 20th through the 22nd. It's in this year in Newport, Rhode Island. Beautiful place, my neck of the woods. I'm from New England, so definitely check that out. SPARKS is the Society for the Promotion of Applied Research in Canine Science, and you can find them online at caninescience.info. And we'll be back in just a few minutes. You're listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may say my dog will always come through.
Eric, people ask me to help them with all sorts of doggy challenges.
I can only imagine.
Oh yeah, dogs jumping on guests, new puppy questions, behavioral challenges like fear and aggression, even dog food sensitivities, you name it, and I've probably worked with it.
But can you help people even if they don't live in Seattle?
Absolutely. I've had great success with phone consultations and have even Skyped with people and their dogs from all over the country. Every dog should be approached as a unique individual. I've talked about this over and over again on the show. That's one of the parts of working with dog training and behavior that I love the most. Every client is different. If you're listening and you need help with your dog, just get in touch. I'd love to get you pointed in the right direction and answer all of your questions. Email me, host@dogradioshow.com. That's me, Julie Forbes, host@dogradioshow.com. I look forward to connecting.
Wait, dogs can use Skype? We're really living in the future.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage on Vashon Island, we cover the world of animals. This week, September 11th, it's a Talk with Your Animals Sunday with gifted animal communicator, medium, and Reiki master Darcy Pariso. Darcy can help you talk with and learn about your animal friends, or help you connect with animal or human loved ones on this side or the other. Plan to give us a call on Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
The Natural Pet Pantry is Seattle's original source for wholesome dog and cat meals, offering 8 different protein options to accommodate your pet's dietary needs. Made locally using all U.S.-sourced ingredients, their freshly ground stews, raw or cooked, can be purchased from their 2 stores in Burien and Kirkland, most independent pet supply stores, or delivered right to your door. Go to naturalpetpantry.com for more information. I'm Julie Forbes, and my first choice for my pet's food is the Natural Pet Pantry. It's the educated choice.
Ready to shake things up? Try Alternative Talk 1150.
And now, back to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
And that he knows he'll get, so I love my dog as much as I love you.
Welcome back to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, and we're back talking with Dr. Monique Udell, who is with the Human Animal Interaction Lab of Oregon State University. Lots of research into kinds, different types of attachment, what types of attachment do dogs form with people, and how is that, how does that manifest, and all sorts of really interesting stuff with the human-animal relationship. And Dr. Udell, I wanted to talk to you next about your one of the studies that you did a few years ago. Wolves outperform dogs in following human social cues, which has to do with pointing. And
yes.
So like in a nutshell, so that we can move on, you know, so the sort of studies were done on this comparing wolves' reaction to like their ability to sort of recognize that cue of somebody standing facing forward, not using their eyes or other body language other than just their arm and hand, to just stand staring forward and point to the side to a bucket. And when the animal's eye, or when they go to the bucket or follow that cue, then they get rewarded with a treat gets dropped, and then there's a click. Is that right, basically? Or am I missing?
Yeah, that's basically correct. And that's how a lot of the pointing tests work. There's not always a click. Sometimes the food's just dropped. In this particular study, there was, but really that it turns out is not important to the task. Basically, it's just, you know, you point to one of two objects. If the dog or the wolf follows that point to the object that you chose, then it gets food. And if it goes to the other object, which is on the other side, then it gets nothing.
Okay. And does it have to, how is the response measured as a success or as a positive? Like the dog's eyes follow or they actually go up and eat the food? Or no, I'm sorry, go up and approach and get how close to?
Yeah, so they have to either touch the can or get their muzzle within 10 centimeters of the can, which is, in all practical terms, so close that it looks like they're touching the can. But you can't always be 100% sure unless the can wiggles if that's what happens. So they either have to come within centimeters of the can or actually touch
it. And what was of interest to me was the pre-training part of this. And was there a pre-training part of these studies that were done before you also?
Where? Yes, and really pre-training is an awful choice of term.
Okay.
Unfortunately, pretty much all of the tests that came before used pre-training, but really it's not so much a training as it is just an exposure to the fact that food is available. So it involves typically just dropping the food onto the cans and showing them that there is food in this environment and that it can be found on cans. And it sort of prepares them for the following experience of actually following the point.
Okay.
Because, you know, there needs to be some motivation to potentially pay attention.
Okay.
And that's the motivation.
So the cans on either side are established both equally that they produce food. And then once that is introduced, then it's okay. When I point to that one, does the dog or wolf go to that one as opposed to the other one to say, hey, does that mean that there's food? Now, are they in some sort of wait command or are they being held? How are they being kept a distance?
Most of the time they're held. In some studies, they can just get the animals to sit. In ours, we had someone distracting the wolves at a distance or distracting the dogs at a distance. So sort of, you know, keeping a hand on them and maintaining their attention.
And then
the person was ready to point.
Okay. And so were they let go of at the same time as the point happened?
Basically, the experimenter issues the point.
Mm-hmm.
So in this particular pointing test, the point is given while the animal watches, but it returns back to a neutral point, meaning that the human is no longer pointing at the can when the individual makes the choice.
Got it.
And so in this particular study, I believe it was 2.5 meters. It varies by study. But the point was completely gone by the time the wolves or the dogs passed that line.
Okay.
So they had to make the choice after seeing the point, but it was from memory at that instance.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So now tell me, just in, you know, because listen, I'm not a scientist. I can understand this. I have some level of education in science, but mm-hmm. most people probably listening don't. Will you describe in just sort of, you know, a way that people would understand, what's the point?
Haha. Sure. So the basic idea here is we want to see whether the dogs and wolves are really paying attention to what we're doing. So are they really aware that the human is over there, you know, making this point in the first place, and do they reliably go to where that gesture indicated? So are they capable of using human actions or using cues to inform their behavior to their advantage in the environment?
Okay.
And what this tells us is it's sort of, for me, it's a proxy of how often they may do this in their day-to-day lives. How have they learned that humans are a valuable source of information in their lives?
Yeah. And so really the difference is studying how does that vary between wolves and dogs and the question of what role does domestication have in that?
Partly, yes. And that's one of the reasons for the comparison. But there are other things you can ask as well, like what kind of experiences make dogs more sensitive to human actions, you know, performing in agility or dogs that are, you know, involved in other tasks or in a lot of training that involves paying attention to people versus dogs that are maybe more engaged in independent tasks like search and rescue dogs. Or does breed have a role? So you can ask a number of questions, but one of the questions is initially was, why are dogs good at this? And could domestication be the answer? And that was the thing that we were testing in this particular study.
Yeah. So I thought it was is this the first and only measure of this kind of thing as far as using the pointing? Are there other
in terms of gesture response?
Yeah. Social cues.
Yeah, no, there are so many ways to test social responsiveness in animals. And so we've looked at perspective taking, how sensitive animals are to whether or not we're looking at them or where we're looking in the environment. You can test, like we talked about before, attachment behavior, just whether they're using the presence of an individual as a cue to explore the environment. So pointing is by no means the only measure of this, but it's become a popular one in part because now that it's picked up so much momentum, there are so many possibilities to compare between different groups of dogs or different breeds or different species that have been tested before with this really consistent methodology that's easily transferable across groups.
Mm-hmm. I think the place where I get, and I've had been looking at your work for a few days and, you know, there's a lot I don't know about this. But what struck me is what do we assume a point means to a dog? Because and I know the point is that it's a human social cue, but it's really not a social cue. Well, I guess do you define a social cue as, hey, there's food? Because I guess bees do that. They dance to let everyone else know where they found food. So is it social? I guess to me, I was kind of feeling like this is the individual dog or wolf either figuring out or not how to get the food. But what did it really mean about their relationship with, you know, like it was just kind of like about the food and them kind of following food. Not to say it's not valuable, but I was just sort of, I guess, struck by that. And then also that there was, what does a point mean to us? Just as an example, what does a point mean to us without using eyes at all? Because dogs use their mouths like we use our hands. And how do they experience and read our body language as dogs or wolves or as canids versus us humans? And there's all these really awesome ways that people and dogs really just can communicate. I don't know about wolves, but where dogs get quality of energy, like presence, body language. How does somebody feel? Does somebody feel confident or not? They know the difference. Like all those, you know, and I'm not saying this related to a study. It's just experiential. Mm-hmm. So I was just curious about like the point part of it. And like, oh my gosh, I want to be able to like, you know, have all these studies done using all different types of cues and not using food and using, you know, like it just opens up like, basically just gets me spinning.
Oh, yeah. No, it's wonderful. Years and years more of research. You're keeping me in work, so I appreciate it. But, so the choice of a point really originated from the human and non-human primate literature because, like you say, pointing is so important to us as people, and it does play a big role, especially in our interactions with children and pre-verbal children. Some of the first ways that they can communicate once in their environment is being able to reach for things or point to things. And so it plays an important role in our environment and in our development. And so when it was sort of transferred over, Brian Hare was the first to use it with dogs. And the reason why it became a topic of interest is because many species at that time had not been found to be very good at following human points to locate things in space. Especially when you think of the species at the time that had been tested, many of them were lab-reared species, so they didn't have a lot of the same experiences that you would encounter in a home. And so it's not surprising that these cues didn't mean a whole lot to them.
Mm-hmm.
But for dogs, I mean, dogs live in homes with us. They are watching us, and they see us do all sorts of things, whether or not we're aware of it. And just like we learn to pick up on subtle cues that are unique to dogs that we don't share with them, like their hackles going up or their tail going between their legs, we can sort of learn what that corresponds with in their environment and know something about what's going on, or at least maybe to some extent, maybe how they feel, or that they're going to maybe respond in a particular way based on their cues. And dogs have this ability too. They're really good at picking up on physical cues. They use them with other dogs, and so they have all this visual signaling. And wolves also have all of this really rich visual signaling that they use with each other. And so I think it's not incredibly surprising that when you have dogs or wolves that have been raised around people and have bonded to people through socialization early in their life, that they can start to learn about what our cues mean, what we're doing, you know, when we drop something and go to reach for it, and if that thing might be a food item. Dogs are pretty quick to figure out that somebody who is carrying food that's bending over and reaching in a particular direction is probably indicating where that food might be. And most of our dogs would probably run over and try to snatch it before we got it, unless they're really well trained. My interpretation is that they're picking up on these same sorts of things in these tests, especially when it involves something like food or a toy, like a ball that you might throw, because they have lots of experience with us, you know, sticking our arm out and provisioning food or throwing treats, and the direction of the arm necessarily predicts where that thing went. And we also find that dogs and wolves are pretty good at following a pointing with the foot, because probably for the same reason, when we kick their toys or kick their balls, the direction of our foot predicts where that thing went. So they may use those cues more than we realize in their home environment. But then you get to some of these other cues, like you're mentioning, these more subtle cues, like, you know, maybe a slight head turn or, you know, pointing with your elbow is another one we've done that are sort of wacky cues that they wouldn't necessarily see in their environment as much, or maybe are these really small, subtle movements that don't mean as much to their day-to-day lives.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not as sensitive to those.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of this combination of, yes, they have evolved to be around us to some extent. But on the other hand, if they're going to live in our environment, they may be using some of those tools that they already had in their belt from being these highly visual signalers. They have to learn about these new body parts, these new types of signals that they may not engage in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of a smaller leap than we may have originally thought.
Mm. So it's sort of measuring how have they learned about how, like, our language as humans, as a function living with us. And it's interesting, mm-hmm. because if you think of a pointer, like a German mm-hmm. short-haired pointer or whatever, you know, a dog, and those dogs point, and what do their bodies look like when they point, and what do they point with? It's like their heads. So I'd be curious to know, you know, numbers of trials that you did where the human pointed with their head versus with, so that would be the dog's language versus with our hand, which would be our language, versus with mm-hmm. like our like butt or something, or elbow maybe, that would have like nothing, we would never do that. And like to mm-hmm. Compare the success with speaking the dog's language versus speaking our language versus just being weird. And pointing with that they wouldn't necessarily see.
Yeah, and I think it's important to keep in mind, too, that the way that they may signal something in their environment
right.
and the way that they see others in their environment signaling may be very different.
Right.
So, you know, you have this dog that, you know, maybe you have a pointer, and, you know, when it sees something, a stimulus moving in the environment, it you know, gets into this position. But let's say there aren't any other pointers around in that household, and that dog most of the time hangs out with people. What that dog is seeing is mostly our body language, you know? So there's this correspondence of, do they need to be able to do it to be able to learn about it? And so that's sort of the question. It's interesting. We've done all sorts of gestures, not just pointing. We've done, you know, bending in the direction of the target, which is kind of similar to the type of, you know, mm-hmm. sticking your head out that you'd imagine. We've been, you know, just looking at the container and you get great variability. Different dogs are more or less sensitive to different types of gestures, which I think maybe even lends further to the idea that dogs are learning strategies for successful communication or successful interpretation of cues that are important to them in their environments and aren't necessarily all going to respond the same way to the same thing.
Yeah. And that's, I think, an important point. And you spoke to this in your discussion just about, you know, an individual's, rather than it being like a purely a genetic difference based off of domestication, that it might have, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that it has maybe more to do with the individual's experience, upbringing, relationships, you know, all of these other factors that play into it, rather than just the difference. Oh, our study suggests that environment and development affect a social animal's ability to react in situation-appropriate ways to the social cues of other individuals. I mean, we see that with humans. There's some humans that run around shooting, you know, that kill people, and they're people. They're, you know, not genetically different species-wise from, like, me. I would never do that. So it's interesting.
Yeah. There's just a lot of evidence for this variation. And I think that's an example of our understanding evolving, that, you know, science is sort of an ongoing changing process. Mm. And, you know, these ideas are put out there, but then we have to test them and say, you know, does this hold true in every case? And now we're finding that wolves can be good at this, can be very responsive to human gestures and actions and attentional state. They can seek out affection. But it depends on their upbringing. You know, if they're raised in a particular way where they're, you know, constantly being cuddled by humans and they stay around humans for their entire life, they're going to show more of these behaviors than, you know, if they were raised in a different way or maybe living in the wild. We shouldn't necessarily expect them to act the same way. Mm. And now we're seeing this with tons of other species. It's really been interesting over the last few years where we're seeing others socialize a range of animals, including crows and jackdaws, and, you know, they've looked at elephants, and we've done bats, and animals that have been raised around humans and are also highly social are often good at these tasks. It's not just dogs, and it's not even just canines. You know, to see a bat follow a point is a pretty interesting thing, and their body language is incredibly different.
Yeah.
But if those cues are valuable to them and their environment, it doesn't really matter if they do it. But if they can get good things by paying attention to that in their environment, then they often do.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, I want to talk about what you'll be talking about at Sparks and just a little more about the other work that you do, and then just recap Sparks again. So Dr. Monique Udell is one of the presenters at the second annual Sparks conference that's coming up June 20th, 21st, and 22nd in Newport, Rhode Island. It's a gathering of world-renowned scientists working with dogs and canids, so dogs and wolves, and, you know, just really about how they think, how they learn, their relationships, social aspects, all sorts of interesting stuff. There's a whole bunch of different presenters. You can go to caninescience.info for more information, get tickets to go and see these wonderful people present in person, or you can watch streaming live as well. And there's different membership levels. Caninescience.info is that website, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Few minutes. You're listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. I guess you gotta come down.
Cause I never felt so free. It was just my dog and me.
The Natural Pet Pantry is Seattle's original source for wholesome dog and cat meals, offering 8 different protein options to accommodate your pet's dietary needs. Made locally using all U.S.-sourced ingredients, their freshly ground stews, raw or cooked, can be purchased from their 2 stores in Burien and Kirkland, most independent pet supply stores, or delivered right to your door. Go to naturalpetpantry.com for more information. I'm Julie Forbes, and my first choice for my pet's food is the Natural Pet Pantry. It's the educated choice.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
This is Julie Forbes. I'm excited to tell you about Farm Dog Naturals, a company that handcrafts herbal remedies for the all-natural dog. Quality and integrity are must-haves for anything that I recommend. Certified eco-friendly and cruelty-free, their products address issues like stress and anxiety, itching, hot spots, crusty noses, as well as pet urine, stains, and odor. Farm Dog Naturals is guaranteed, and I'm so happy with the results I'm seeing. Shipping is available worldwide from their website, farmdognaturals.com, or you can ask for them at a retailer near you. Again, that's farmdognaturals.com.
Self-help, healing, spirituality, and more on Alternative Talk, 1150.
And now, back to the Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
Welcome back to the Dog Show with Julie Forbes. And we're back talking with Dr. Monique Udell, who's one of the featured speakers at this second annual Sparks Conference. Sparks is an acronym, Society for the Promotion of Applied Research in Canine Science. And it is a wonderful gathering of world-renowned scientists in the field of studying how dogs think, how dogs behave and interact with people, how that might differ from wolves, all sorts of different angles on it. It's really incredible. Last year was the first year that they did it, and it was just awesome. I was totally blown away. And definitely get in on this. If you can't go in person, you can watch it streaming live. You can watch it archived. You can watch last year's. Go to caninescience.info for the website. So Dr. Udell is one of the speakers this year, and you spoke last year as well.
I did.
And what will you be talking about this year, in a nutshell?
So, in a nutshell, yeah. One of the things that people often remark about at not only conferences like this one, which is great because it brings together so many different perspectives and scientists from different areas, but just in general about science is that you hear all of these different things about how the brain regulates behavior, or, you know, this behavior might be a product of learning, and then someone else will say how it's a product of ethology or evolution, or from all these different perspectives. And I often get asked, or we often get asked, you know, which is right? Which should we use when we do, you know, engage in dog training? What should we pay attention to? And so my talk this year is going to be an attempt to demonstrate how actually all of these different fields of science are asking important questions that will come together to give us a bigger picture of sort of a universal truth. So we're all trying to get at, you know, the same truth about dogs or a better understanding of dogs, but just from different angles and different perspectives. And there's going to be an experiment or experiential part of the story, and there's going to be an evolutionary part of the story and a biological part of the story. And it's just a matter of sort of bearing with us scientists as we hash out the details of where each of these fields can make the best contributions to this whole picture. And so I'm going to try to help dog trainers and other individuals in the applied setting make sense of these sometimes seemingly very different perspectives that they get from scientists, and how they could, instead of, you know, choosing between them, hopefully try to integrate them into something that's even more powerful.
Imagine that. I think it's awesome. I think it's great that you're like, hey, it's not like one only, but that, you know, you get to pick one, and that's all you get to work with for every dog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah. I mean, thanks for like bringing voice to this, because it's, gosh, this kind of thing plays out all over the place where it's like, no, my thing, no, you know, and it's like, well, let's look at everything and be able to hold all of the information that we have each time we're presented with a new case, and sort of mm-hmm. mix and match in a way that's going to best suit the individual that we're working with.
For sure. And it's a challenging thing to do, because mm-hmm. it's not the way our society is set up most of the time. You know, we live in a very competitive society, and just the portrayal of the way that science is done and you know, the conclusions that are, you know, put out there It looks like things are in conflict in some cases when they aren't. And sometimes, you know, the scientists that appear to be in conflict get along well and are actually really good friends and really agree with each other's work. And so sometimes there appears to be conflict where there isn't. And then even where there doesn't appear to be conflict, sometimes it can be really hard to integrate information because the language used in different sciences is so different. So the vocabulary used in a behavioral learning theory field is incredibly different from one that's used in evolutionary psychology. I mean, the one term, function, what is the function of behavior, means dramatically different things across fields. And so a lot of the confusion comes from this inability to translate this information across not only the sciences, but then translate it to a whole other field of animal training or animal care. Mm-hmm. So that's the challenge. And it's not an easy one, but I agree it needs to be addressed.
Something that's just struck me that you said was appear where there may appear to be conflict when there isn't. Mm-hmm. And something that I just thought I'd throw out there for you and hear what you have to say about it is that one of the things that's kind of refreshing, I think, about working with dogs is that there's either, if there's conflict, it's apparent. I mean, assuming mm-hmm. you know how to read subtleties in body language and hardening of eyes. I mean, it's not always obvious as far as like a full-on lunge and snap. But with dogs, it's like their experience is usually, if we're in conflict, we're in conflict in this moment. And then when it's over, we're not in conflict anymore. And it's mm-hmm. a difference between people who are very complicated when it comes to that kind of thing. And has it been your experience that with your work with dogs and wolves, like that there, have you ever felt like you've seen where there appeared or where there was conflict when there didn't appear to be?
In terms of the work or in terms of the dog's behavior?
In terms of the just dogs in general, like that's something appearing to be in conflict. It's like they either are or aren't. So it's almost like something that is specific to humans as opposed to dogs who are either are and are going to show it in that moment and then aren't. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's an interesting point. I mean, and it does sort of coming down then if you're using body language as the signal, for example.
Right.
I think there are sometimes miscommunications, especially when you're talking about dogs with different socialization histories or maybe dogs of different breeds that have different physical features, where one dog is maybe trying to signal play and the other dog interprets that incorrectly and conflict begins. So I think in some cases there might be a disjunct between what one individual perceives as conflict and what another individual perceives as play. But whether or not, does that conflict necessarily persist? Well, I don't know. To some extent, maybe it does, because I think there's some evidence that once dogs, in some cases, form an impression of something or someone in their environment as a threat, which you could potentially interpret as conflict, that can persist. I know my dog, when she was a puppy, had a couple of dogs in the neighborhood that were just nasty to her.
Yeah.
And she's not forgotten that a year and a half later. She knows who those dogs are, even if she can smell them around the block.
Yeah.
So
I still don't like you.
Example.
Yeah. Well, when I was, right when I finished talking, I thought of my male cattle dog. And he, we have a lot of dogs in and out of our house. Just like we have, friends' dogs who we watch or whatever for different reasons. And there's, a couple dogs that he just isn't crazy about. And they come back and he doesn't like them and still doesn't. And he's fine. Like he's not going to get into a fight, but he's going to, do any damage or anything. But he's going to definitely express his displeasure with the presence of that animal.
Yeah.
So it actually, I kind of felt like, there is a little kind of ongoing drama that just is there. I mean, I don't, whether he thinks about this dog when the dog's not there, I doubt it. But when he's back, it's like, we're just always, there's a general conflict always just because you're here. Your presence is conflict.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's advantageous, you know, if you're, especially if you were, you know, fending for yourself, maybe not so much when you're being provisioned for by humans, but especially if you're fending for yourself, you know, you have to keep some sort of recollection of what might be a potential threat to you in the future, and to not let it escalate to the point where you could potentially become victimized. So, yeah, I think so.
So you have a border collie.
I do.
And I was telling Dr. Udell about the Vashon sheepdog trials that happen every year in Seattle. Are you familiar with Vashon Island? Have you heard of it?
I haven't. I'm still sort of new to the area, so
okay.
I'm excited to hear about it.
Yeah, it's just west of the city. So it's, we have a whole bunch of islands that are, you know, a lot of them are north and all that. Vashon is actually directly west of Seattle, and it's just a quick ferry ride from West Seattle, and it's a great event. And when you said you had a border collie, it's like, you need to check this out, because it's so awesome to watch them doing their thing, and to experience the working relationship also between human and dog, and to experience that communication, and then also watch how the dogs, so, you know, talk about I don't know which one is right, but between the dogs and the sheep, and how the sheep know if the dog is confident or not, and that the dog has to adjust. It's, I don't know. There's just a lot going on, and it's so cool to watch.
Yeah, definitely.
Where are you from?
Originally, I'm from Florida.
Okay.
So I had lived there pretty much my whole life before moving out to Oregon.
And how long have you been in Oregon?
About a year and a half.
Okay.
So not too long. Welcome
to the Northwest.
Thank you. I enjoy the Northwest. It's a beautiful place, and it's definitely a very dog-friendly place. Lots of dogs. It's wonderful for me.
Cool. So you'll be flying out to where I'm from. I'm from Massachusetts, so just south of there, to the Sparks Conference. And will you be presenting on all 3 days?
I will be presenting on the Sunday.
So okay.
I believe that's June 22nd.
Yeah. And have you met a lot of the other presenters this year, or a lot of these people, will this be your first time meeting, or how well do you know them?
You know, I've met a good number of them. And those that I haven't met, I've interacted with at one level or another. So I'm really excited for this year's conference, actually getting to see some people in the field that I really respect, and they're going to have really exciting talks, I can tell you already. And others that, you know, I've been reading their work for years, and it's just really interesting, from personality to applications for, you know, dogs in shelters, to, you know, the biology of, you know, all sorts of stuff, olfaction and vocalization. So it's going to be really interesting this year. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to have to participate from a distance this year, but I'm still looking forward to it. So caninescience.info is the website. Again, you can go on and look at all of the different presenters that will be talking, and the schedule. And some of them are back from last year. Dr. Ray Coppinger was presented last year. Catherine Lord last year. Clive Wynn last year. I talked with Clive on the show last year, too. And then you. And then some new ones also.
Yeah.
So it's really, really a cool thing. So you do, you run, are you, I think you said, it said that you're an assistant professor also at Oregon State?
I am. I'm an assistant professor in the Animal and Rangeland Sciences Department. And within that department, I work with the Human-Animal Interaction Lab. I direct that lab.
Cool. So what is the part of all of this, like, what inspires you to do this work? Like, what is it? Is there something that you're after? Or do you even know, you know, like, where you're doing all of these, you know, really formal studies and all that? Like, what is the motivation for you?
My first reaction is I should say something like, I'm after the truth. But, and I guess I am, in a sense, but I've always been fascinated by animal behavior. And, you know, for as long as I can remember, I wanted to work with animals. And I just have a curiosity about, you know, how we coexist with animals, especially, and why they do the things they do and why we do the things that we do. And especially if you think about dogs or even just urban animals that share this environment with us so closely, living in our houses, living in our communities and in our environments, and the interactions that we have with them on a daily basis and haven't really thought about as deeply as we've studied some other species, because for a long time, the study of domesticated species, especially pets, was just not considered within the scientific realm. You know, it was sort of not well respected. And I think that's changed a lot over the last few decades, but especially over the last few years. Mm-hmm. And so there's just so much to learn about these animals that we have such a close relationship with. And I just want to know more. And I want to share that knowledge with other people so we can keep building on those relationships and improving them.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time, and I've really, really enjoyed having you on the show and talking with you and learning about what you do. I think your work is so interesting, and I love the voice that you're bringing also to the community.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Dr. Monique Udell for your time today. Thanks for listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
You've been listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, Wednesday afternoons at 2 on Alternative Talk 1150 AM. Never miss another episode. Listen to our podcast online at dogradioshow.com or download them for free on iTunes or SoundCloud.